Good afternoon. We're continuing the story from last week, which is on the inside of your handout, Acts chapter 15. We're going to start halfway down the page at verse 30. Halfway down the first page there. So, when Silas and Judas were sent off from Jerusalem, they went down to Antioch, and having gathered the congregation together, they delivered the letter. And when the congregation had read it, they rejoiced because of its encouragement. And Judas and Silas, who were themselves prophets, encouraged and strengthened the brothers with many words. And after they had spent some time, they were sent off in peace by the brothers to those who had sent them. But Paul and Barnabas remained in Antioch, teaching and preaching the word of the Lord with many others also. And after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaimed the word of the Lord, and see how they are." Now Barnabas wanted to take with them John called Mark, but Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and who had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp disagreement, so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, having been commended by the brothers to the grace of the Lord. And he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Paul came also to Derbe and to Lystra. A disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek. He was well spoken of by the brothers at Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted Timothy to accompany him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those places, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. As they went on their way through the cities, they delivered to them for observance the decisions that had been reached by the apostles and elders who were in Jerusalem. And so the churches were strengthened in the faith, and they increased in numbers daily.
Thank you, Derek, and may I add my welcome to Alfie's. If it is your first time here for a little while, you've come at a good time. We've just got to one of the critical turning points in Christian history. It was pivotal at the time, and it's equally important for us here today. We're about 15 or 20 years after the death of Jesus. Jesus had told his disciples right at the beginning of this book that they would be his witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the end of the earth. And we've actually put that verse on the handout just above the introduction to this talk. And as Jesus had foretold, so it was happening. The church has spread fast out of Jerusalem, across Judea, Samaria, Cilicia, Syria, and especially to Antioch, and from there into Asia Minor through Paul's first missionary journey. And now the leaders and representatives of the whole Christian church have just concluded an international church summit in Jerusalem, known as the Jerusalem Council. And the big issue which has led to this council might seem a bit weird to us. It's about circumcision. The debate at the council was about whether Christians have to be circumcised like the Jews in order to be saved, in order to be proper Christians, as it were. That's the presenting issue, but underlying it is a profound question. It's a question at its most basic of how you get to heaven, about how people are saved, about how we can be put right with God, about how we can get out of the mess we've made before it's too late and we have to face God's judgment. Is it enough just to put complete faith in Jesus Christ, or is more required? Do we have to keep a whole pile of rules as well? Specifically in today's passage, do people have to keep the Jewish law and customs from the Old Testament and get circumcised as well? And if this question is not settled, it's creating such a rift that the growth in the church will doubtless grind to a halt and church unity will be shattered. And the problem's arisen because there are Jews in these early days who claim that simple, complete faith in Jesus isn't enough. They claim that even if people aren't Jewish, they must observe Jewish law and customs as well. In practical terms, if people are to be saved, they've got to live like Jews. To them, the gospel of Jesus just isn't enough. Ritual, rules, religion, rote, circumcision have to be added. In other words, they want to edit the gospel. And as Alfie showed us last week, the Jerusalem Council resolved this issue completely and unanimously, because it realised, looking at what God had done and by reading what he'd said in the scriptures, that faith in Jesus Christ as Lord is all that God requires for us to be put right with him. It's both necessary and sufficient for our salvation. There's no need to obey a set of rules or to live like Jews. There's no need to add anything else or edit the gospel in any way. Indeed, we must not. So important and so momentous was the decision that the council agreed a letter announcing the decision, and this letter was to be circulated throughout the churches of the day, primarily to Antioch and from there elsewhere. And we began our reading, Derek began today, thank you Derek for reading that so well to us, at verse 30 of our passage, with Paul and Barnabas setting off for Antioch to deliver this letter. And when they'd read it, we read in the next verse, in verse 31, the congregation rejoiced because of its encouragement. So that's the big issue resolved. We're saved by faith in Jesus Christ alone. We can contribute nothing to our salvation, and we can do nothing to earn it. No duties, rituals, ceremonies, or anything are going to help us. No one needs to be circumcised or to follow any other customs. It doesn't matter how often we go to church, whether we're so-called pillars of society or whether we're dregs of society. Our salvation depends only on Jesus and our faith in him. This is the gospel of Jesus. He's done it all, and it brought great encouragement to the church. And it also brings us to our first takeaway today. See the first heading, at all costs, stick resolutely to Jesus' gospel. Because if it's the only way we can be saved, then surely it must be our top priority. And we must hang on to it at all costs. Stick to the gospel, stand up for it, argue for it, at all costs, come what may. Just as Paul and Barnabas did. At the Jerusalem Council, they faced opponents who claimed the authority of James, the Jerusalem church leader. Even the Apostle Peter at one stage was led astray and opposed Paul and Barnabas. They faced people who'd lived with Jesus, who'd seen him after his resurrection. And no doubt there were some big personalities there too. Could have been quite intimidating. But Paul and Barnabas argued vehemently for the simple gospel, no editing. And in the end, the council agreed unanimously. And we've only got to read Paul's letters to the early churches to see how absolutely he and Barnabas and their fellow workers fought for this. For them, as for the other apostles after this, sticking resolutely to Jesus' gospel at all costs meant for many of them at the cost of their lives. What is the gospel? What is Jesus' gospel? It's that Jesus has done everything necessary for us to have peace with God and eternal life. And he achieved this by sacrificing himself, by dying on the cross for us. That's it. He's done it. There's nothing we can add. As Alfie put it last week, no additions. And there'll always be pressure to add to the gospel at work, at home, even in church, or if not to edit it. There'll be pressure to insist as well on philanthropy or religious observance or works of charity or a particular ceremony or experience. There might be pressure to water down the gospel because of corporate values or policies or to achieve targets. And our top priority as Christians is to stick resolutely to it at all costs. No additions. No editing. This is fundamental. This is a red line. But what if you're here as a skeptic, or you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, or you've no particular view, but you're interested? Jesus' gospel of grace is still all you need. Start there, please. Don't get sidelined into discussions of philosophy or abstract theology. Start with Jesus and his gospel. It's all that really matters, and everything else flows from it. In comparison with Jesus, everything else in this world is crud, and it will disappear. But what about other issues? If you like, non-red line issues. Not connected directly to the gospel, but issues we have to deal with in life. Other aspects of Christian living. How should we relate to people who disagree with us? How flexible should we be in engaging and sharing and eating and working with others who've got a different view of the gospel or of a different faith? How far are we to go in accommodating practices we're not used to? Whether in churches or our own churches or others or in our workplace or elsewhere. Because after all, we have to live in this world. We're not here to shrink from it. And this is where today's passage has things to say to us. Essentially, in all else, be flexible. We've only got two headings today, and this is the second one. And I'd like us to look in a minute at Paul's decision to circumcise Timothy. But first, we have this strange passage that Derek read for us in verses 36 to 39. And I'm going to read it again, starting at verse 36. Now Barnabas wanted to take with them John called Mark, but Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp disagreement, so that they separated from each other. Paul and Barnabas have a row, a humdinger of a row. It's kind of as if the firm you're working for, the chairman and the CEO, win a great victory. Maybe they fight off a takeover bid, or they win agreement for a major step forward for the industry. And the next thing you know, they've had a sucking great row and split up, and one of them's left the firm. And you think they've just won a big one. And their win's warmly received. It's united everybody, clarified the way forward. So what on earth have they split up for? A bit of background here, because Mark had left Paul and Barnabas in the middle of their first missionary journey, and he'd gone home early. These long journeys were tough, and they could be dangerous. Paul probably wasn't the easiest of people to get along with. Small groups travelling together would be very reliant on each other. Maybe Paul felt Mark had proved unreliable once, and he just didn't want Mark on the other end of the rope again. Barnabas was the encourager. Mark was his cousin. Maybe he felt Mark just needed a bit of encouragement to become a full team player and worker. And so in a way, this is a classic dilemma about the interests of the individual as against the interests of the team. Whatever, Luke just records the events here. It's sad, but he tells it like it is. He places no blame. He makes no judgment about who's right or wrong, so neither should we. But we can take two points away from this. First of all, the split was not about Jesus' gospel. It was not about our red line. Neither Paul nor Barnabas sought to deny or edit the gospel in any way. In the terms of our first heading, there were no red lines at stake here. This was just an argument about tactics, about a person. Not about what to do so much as about how to do it, about who to take on the journey, not whether to make it. The second thing we can say is that the row was eventually resolved. Later, Barnabas becomes a colleague of Paul again, and Paul accepts Mark, calling him a fellow worker and very useful for my ministry. And in fact, Mark and Silas both went on to have significant ministries themselves. So out of this sad episode, two workers, Paul and Barnabas, become four. And God, in his wisdom, uses the split to multiply his workers. So should we take this as an encouragement to argue then and have disagreements? I don't think so. The issue wasn't Jesus' gospel. It wasn't a red line issue, as we said. It was about how best to serve and how best to witness to Jesus to the ends of the earth. And dare I say it, I think it's a pity Paul and Barnabas between them couldn't have found some flexibility. Surely what we should take away from this sad incident is not that we should look for arguments, but that we should show flexibility in our dealings so as to best promote Jesus' gospel. And then we come in the last section of our passage today, and here we do see a great example of Paul's flexibility in our last five verses, chapter 16. At first sight, this looks bizarre. In that momentous decision, the Jerusalem Council ends up supporting Paul and Barnabas and supporting them unanimously. Faith in Jesus' gospel is enough for salvation. We don't need anything else, and you don't need to be circumcised. And now just about the very next thing Paul does is he goes and gets Timothy circumcised. Let's read it, verses 1 to 3 in chapter 16. Paul came also to Derbe and to Lystra. By the way, those were the last towns he visited on his first missionary journey. So he's going back. They're going back to sort of see how they're getting on. To the churches that they'd planted there before. So they go to Derbe and Lystra, and a disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer. But his father was a Greek, and he was well spoken of by the brothers at Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted Timothy to accompany him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in those places, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. So it's almost as if the chairman of our firm, having won that hugely important debate, secured unanimous agreement for his position, has now not only split from his CEO, but he's going back and doing the opposite of what he's been arguing for. Almost like that, but not quite. Why does Paul do this? Timothy has a Jewish mother, so he's technically Jewish. His father's a Greek, the implication being that Timothy hasn't been circumcised. So technically, therefore, in Jewish eyes, he is an apostate. He's a kind of lapsed Jew. And the people in the area know this because Timothy's a local guy. Paul wants Timothy to help him preach the gospel, but to take Timothy as an apostate Jew into the synagogue would just raise hackles. It won't help the gospel. So he avoids an unnecessary barrier in the way of people hearing the gospel, and he decides to make an honest Jew of Timothy and have him circumcised. He wants to keep the way open to witness to the Jews as well as to the non-Jews. And it's important to note, of course, that Timothy is already a believer. It's not as if somehow circumcision is making him a Christian. It's not essential, so it doesn't really matter. Paul may have argued vehemently and at all costs for the purity and sufficiency of the gospel, but he was flexible in this non-essential matter. And as that great Christian John Newton once put it, Paul was an iron pillar in essentials, but he was a reed in non-essentials. And Christians do have the freedom not to accept the Jewish rules. Paul uses that freedom here for the sake of harmony between believers and to advance the gospel. And he uses the freedom not to circumcise Timothy by circumcising him. And if we look right back to the opening verse of our passage, not where Derek started reading, but right at the beginning, we can see that this is precisely in line with the conclusion of James, presiding at the Jerusalem Council, when he concluded, "We should not trouble those of the Gentiles who turn to God." In other words, we should not trouble non-Jews who turn to God. We shouldn't start putting things in their way. We shouldn't erect barriers. And this is surely a great help in guiding us today. We have great freedom through Jesus' gospel. But that freedom is not to please ourselves, because that's how humanity got into the mess to start with, by pleasing ourselves. Our freedom is to serve Jesus. Freedom to be flexible in witnessing and promoting his gospel. And we exercise that freedom best by sticking resolutely to that gospel, not editing it, but also by showing flexibility when we engage with others in the world around us, and so encouraging fellow believers and witnessing to people who don't believe. We've got the freedom to be flexible about non-essentials. We'll meet other Christians with other backgrounds, people who agree on the gospel of Jesus perhaps, but differ about the format of church services, about music, about types, about whether you're conservative or charismatic, about whether you have a choir or whether you wear robes, how often you go, what you do about communion. Let's not let differences about this sort of stuff impede the gospel. And let's not let it stop us encouraging other Christians. So what if others prefer cathedrals or village halls for their services, or like to meet in bars or nightclubs as we do? The gospel is the gospel, whether we're in church, in a cathedral, or in a sewer. So a friend of mine, a Church of England vicar, will generally preach and take services without wearing a dog collar. But if not wearing one might put his audience off and impede his witness, he'll wear one. He's even been known to wear robes on occasion in order not to put a barrier in the way of the gospel, to maximise opportunities to witness and strengthen people's faith. This is not about people pleasing. We don't need to do that. It's about not giving offence unnecessarily. The gospel often causes offence, and that's fine. If people are offended by the gospel, it might mean they've begun to understand it. But let's leave giving offence to the gospel wherever we can. Avoid giving it ourselves over non-essentials. And perhaps we can extend this to colleagues in the office, people with other beliefs. If we're to present the gospel to them, we might need to be flexible, eat with them, accept invitations to debate in their houses or their premises, go along with customs and traditions we're not used to, get out of our Christian comfort zone, as it were, provided they don't cross our red line or try and edit Jesus' gospel. Why refuse? If they're prepared to hear us present the gospel, why trouble people with non-essentials? If they might turn to God, let's not stand in the way. And what's the result of all this? Joy and strengthening of the Christian congregations. We can see that in our passage in verse 31. They rejoiced because of the encouragement of the council's decision and letter. We can see it in verse 32. The brothers were encouraged and strengthened. We see it in verse 41. The churches were strengthened. And in the last verse of our passage, we see the churches were strengthened in the faith, and they increased in numbers daily. Paul stuck to Jesus' gospel at all costs, and he showed flexibility in his treatment of Timothy. As a result, the churches were encouraged and faith was strengthened across the board. Let us, in the same way, resolutely stick to Jesus' gospel, and let us be flexible in all else. Amen.